Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Serene. I'm delighted to say that I am on a train back from Manchester after 3 days of events talking about the Israeli elections with two of my favourite analysts of all things to do with Israeli elections, Dalia Scheindlin and Anshul Pfeffer. Dalia is a pollster who's worked on 7 election campaigns, including the current one. Anshul Pfeffer is a journalist and writer and wrote the excellent biography of Bibi that is in all good bookshops at the moment. And I just wanted to kick off really talking about some of the surprises that we might see in this election. We've been talking over the last few days about what might happen, permutations of different coalitions, what's happening in the polls. I just want to ask you, Dalia, first, what do you think we might see in terms of turnout? Like, how is turnout really going to affect what happens in this election?
Right now, we don't have any indication about what will exactly happen in turnout, but there's no evidence that it's going to be terribly different from last time, despite the fact that everybody thought there would be lower interest. So in terms of polls, I don't see any significant drop so far, but you know, any person would imagine that having a second election so quickly after the first, for such a strange reason that most Israelis didn't really agree with, you might see a drop of interest. The main problem with turnout in the last election was that there was a vast gap between the portion of Jews who turned out versus the portion of Arab Palestinian citizens who turned out. And Jews voted at a rate of over 75%, but Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel voted at probably about 49%. So that's a massive difference, and it means essentially that the Arab citizens of Israel, who make up roughly 13-14% of the adult voting population, are voting at about half their strength. It means that about 93% of the voters are Jews, which of course has a lot to do with the results, because the Jewish population tilts further right than the full population if you factor in the Arabs. And so if they were voting at their strength, we would see something like a breakdown of, well, I mean, it would still be a majority for the right, right?
But in terms of the Arab turnout, so I think what you're saying is if we got up to the 60% again, you could see the joint list getting 13, 14 seats. Could you see it ever getting higher, or are they still issues in the Arab vote in terms of how they feel about the nation state law, other issues, how they feel about their parties?
Well, no country and no population has 100% turnout.
Yeah.
So even if you got up to 60%, you might see maybe one or two more seats. You're not going to see, you know, 15, 16, 17 seats that you might see. Let's see, if there were 13-14 estimated percent of the voting population who are Arab, most seats you could ever imagine would be maybe 15 or 16 seats. We're not going to see 100% turnout, because we never see that anywhere. But you could theoretically look at 13-14 seats, and that would make a difference, because it would, you know, change the balance of breakdown of the votes for the rest of the parties as well. Would it completely shift the size of the blocks? Probably not, but it would bring them closer to parity.
So I think there's some other things happening in terms of the polls, and we've seen some polls starting to show that Likud and Blue or White may be increasing beyond the 30 mark. But could there be some surprises with Yisrael Beiteinu's support, and also with the Yamina party?
I mean, asking about surprises is a little bit of an oxymoron, because if we're looking at surveys, we can only tell what they're telling us. But I think that the unknowns here are whether Netanyahu will get anything close to his outgoing Knesset strength, which theoretically should be 39 seats. And right now he's not polling anywhere near that.
Why'd you say 39? Do you want to explain?
Sure, because he got Likud won 35 seats in April. Moshe Kahlon's party, Kulanu, won 4 seats. They just barely crossed the threshold. And his party was subsumed, reabsorbed into Likud. And so the two of them together, if he had taken all of Kulanu's votes with all the people who voted for Likud last time, he should have 39 seats. But he's only polling at about between 30 and 32. The last couple of polls I've seen had him at 32, but that's still 7 seats missing. And some of them seem to have gone to Lieberman right now. Avigdor Lieberman's party, Yisrael Biteinu, is getting between 9 and 10, even 11 seats. That's been the average throughout this whole time. Actually, since Lieberman pulled down the coalition negotiations and Israel went into new elections, pretty much since that time, which was late May, his poll numbers have been pretty stable. I have to say that I thought they were exaggerated. I had a hunch. The pollsters don't like to go on hunches, but it didn't feel right that all of a sudden a party just doubles itself. Usually if a party grows in elections, we see an incremental rise over the course of the campaign. So the idea that his numbers just suddenly doubled seemed a little bit suspicious, but they have been pretty stable up until now. So the question is whether that's real, or whether in the final moment some of those people go back home, so to speak, to Likud, or whether they were mostly Kahlon voters who you know, don't feel like they have a home at Likud now that Kahlon rejoined Likud, they may stay with Lieberman. Mm. Or whether they'll, you know, or maybe he'll get a surprise extra turnout. I mean, that's also a possibility if there's some sort of, you know, movement beneath the surface that the polls haven't picked up on, but people think that Lieberman did something really cool by standing up to Netanyahu. That could also be the case. But all that's a bit speculation. Again, when you see polls that are that consistent, I'm more inclined to say his range is 9 to 11 seats.
Yeah. Angela, if I could just bring you in, and I think we maybe discuss a little bit about what's happening in the campaign, and you've been very critical of Gantz and his campaign and how he's almost sort of the silent figure in this campaign which people are projecting their hopes onto because he's the anti-BB candidate. Do you want to say a little bit about why you think his campaign has been so lackluster so far?
Well, for a start, what campaign?
Yeah.
It's really hard to describe the contours of the Gantz campaign because usually when we're talking about campaign, you know, what's the main message? What are the main slogans? The nuts and bolts of a campaign, the jingle and the logo, and so many things in the Gantz campaign have not been consistent, and there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, there's more than one blue and white campaign. There's the campaign being run by Gantz's team. There's a campaign being run by Yair Lapid's team. There's a campaign being run by the all-party team. And we're seeing so many different, and it's part of it is also because nowadays everybody can do their own campaign. You can just like put a meme on Twitter and that's a campaign. So there's no discipline in the blue and white campaign. And part of it is because you've got on the one hand Gantz, who is not a politician, this is his second political campaign, but he only arrived in politics 6 or 7 months ago. Well, Lapid is a campaigner and he's been a campaigner probably even before he was a politician. Even when he was a journalist, he was doing all kinds of campaigns. So you've got this really unbalanced duo at the top. The number one is barely running any kind of campaign, while number two is incessantly campaigning and messaging, and is creating a very bad impression on the Israeli electorate. However, as I said, bad impression, they're still doing very well in the polls, probably better than they expected, than anyone expected of them. So I think that we're seeing here a situation where the campaign is not that relevant. Mm. Benny Gantz is there. He is not a very commanding... He hasn't got a very commanding presence. His character is rather bland. But for many people who are looking for the opposite of Netanyahu, actually a bland candidate is sort of the antidote. He's the anti-Netanyahu, and that's actually doing him some favours now.
It's a campaign for the quiet man.
Well, I was just thinking about the fact that this whole time we've been thinking about how bland he is compared to how colourful Netanyahu is, and it really reminds me, I don't know if there's any significance in this, but it reminds me of the French election when Nicolas Sarkozy had just overstayed his welcome in France, and people were tired of the dramas, and they were tired of the gossip, and they wanted. And when they elected François Hollande, I remember everybody said, "Oh, you know, the French people just want somebody boring, and calm who has no drama." And they did not exactly get no drama Obama. In the end, they got a prime minister who had his own troubles, president. But I don't know. You know, it's almost like anybody who's voting for Gantz, maybe they see something in that too. Maybe they're saying we're tired of all these wild rides with Netanyahu. We want something a little bit calmer and stable.
No, I agree with what Daniel is saying, and from speaking with Gantz's people, at some point they sort of got fed up with trying to make a campaign, and they realized that actually this sort of low key person, that low energy campaign, is probably what works best for him, and it's working well. It is working well for blue and white right now. The question is, and this is something I think Doug is more qualified to speak on than I am, but really the question isn't, this was a question in the previous election as well, is where are the votes coming from? Because this is a party which did not exist before 2019, so even one vote is coming from someone else. And since we know where they're coming from, we've seen what happened to Labour and to Meretz in this election, we know they're not coming from the right wing. So whatever we're seeing here is a realignment in the centre left, not a change between the blocks. So once again, you're asking what are the surprises? There aren't that many surprises in this election, except for the one very big surprise, which is not a surprise of changes in the blocks or a surprise of the results. It's a surprise of Avigdor Lieberman coming out and basically shattering the Netanyahu coalition by saying the right wing doesn't have to go with the ultra-Orthodox. And that's the story of this election. And that will continue to be the story after the election when we get down to the nitty-gritty of building a coalition. Mm. And that's going to be the really interesting development. A, are we going to see a realignment of the main forces in Israeli politics? Are we going to see the right, or part of the right, detaching itself from the ultra-Orthodox and joining the centre in, so as not to have to build a coalition with ultra-Orthodox? And will that be what ends Netanyahu's career as Prime Minister?
So, Anshul, you've been saying, while we've been talking about this to lots of different people over the last few days, that you think that the Benny Gantz is not really the vocal, dynamic, loud challenger to Netanyahu. He's kind of the opposition leader by default, but it's Avigdor Lieberman who is actually the one who is now passionately challenging Bibi Netanyahu's place as Prime Minister into the future. Do you want to tell us a bit more about, you know, why you see him as being that challenger, but also what does he want? What's going to be success for him on September the 18th?
Well, first of all, there's an irony here in that Netanyahu can't be brought down by one man. He needs two men to take him down, and that's, you know, that is testament to his staying power and to his to his mastery as a politician. He needs one guy to take him down, another guy to take his place after that.
And then 1,000 analysts and journalists to figure out his legacy.
Of course, and we'll be right. You know, we and our successors will be continue to write his story. I think for Lieberman, the main aim here is to position himself within the structure of power, and his ambition has always been to be the number two guy, to be the power behind the throne. He doesn't really believe that he can be prime minister. Most Israelis see him still as an outsider, not an entirely credible candidate for prime minister. And even now, when he's doing well, he's not polling at anything, even at double digits. He's polling about 8-9% of the total electorate. So that's not a prime minister. Mm. On the other hand, he has been at different periods in his career. At that point, he was the most powerful man. He was Netanyahu's right-hand man in various places, in various spots, and he was main ally in various stages of his career. And I think he's realized that stage of career will never return under Netanyahu. Netanyahu is at a point in his trajectory as leader that there's no room there for a number two. The only way Lieberman can be the second most powerful man in Israel is for the most powerful manager to be someone else other than Netanyahu, and that's what he's embarked on the last few months, on ending the Netanyahu era. And he says so quite clearly in closed meetings which he knows will be leaked out.
But he's Lieberman, I mean, I think it's interesting to reflect on two points. So he's been foreign minister, he's been defence minister, and for whatever reason, whatever might have been offered back in May wasn't enough. So he clearly, along the lines of what you say, he wanted something more. He wanted to make a bigger mark on Israeli politics. But the interesting thing about what he's trying to do is that, you know, there's a sense of trial and error. Like in December 2018, he tried to, you know, attack Bibi from the security perspective and say that he was weak on Gaza, and that almost didn't seem to work, and he almost reached a very low base of support. Like he went down to one of the lowest number of seats that he's won for a very long time. Now the polls look like he's potentially doubled that, so he's kind of bouncing back. So he's, you know, we'd have to say he's a pretty canny political operator, and he's playing this game pretty well, but also at the same time he really wants to do what he thinks is going to win him support, is to, as you say, drive this big wedge between him and the ultra-Orthodox. So do you see that, you know, his minimal requirement is going to be, I am going to build a coalition without the ultra-Orthodox? So is that how we should see September the 18th? The ultra-Orthodox are out?
There's a tendency to measure a politician's worth or his power by the position he holds, and very often that's the case. If you're one of the most senior ministers, Minister of Defence, Minister of Finance, Foreign Minister, that means you're a very powerful politician. Lieberman does not always see politics in that way. He's much more of a power player rather than necessarily someone who's holding a big ministry. And there's a precedent there. Lieberman came into the coalition in 2007 when Olmert was in trouble, and he could have asked for many of the major portfolios. He didn't take any portfolio. They actually cobbled together some like fake thing called the Ministry for Strategic Affairs. And Lieberman said to Olmert at the time, and Olmert asked him, why are you joining my coalition? You're a a right winger, we're a centre left coalition. He said, I want to be close to where the decisions are being made. And that has always been Lieberman's way. He doesn't necessarily need a title or a big ministry. He wants to be at the very centre of power. And that's what he's playing for now. He's not Netanyahu was willing to give him in April, May, during the negotiations, any post he could have asked for. But Lieberman has just wants to be at the centre, and now he understands that he cannot do that if the Prime Minister's name is Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's why, since he still sees a future for himself in politics, and the role he wants is to be the number two or the power behind the throne, whatever you call it, he needs a new Prime Minister to enable that.
Mm. And in terms of the polling, I was going to ask you, Dahlia, in terms of, you know, what the support is for this kind of position, where it's like, you know, the ultra-Orthodox are out and we don't want them sort of dictating Jewish law in the public sphere, and, you know, the sort of sense of inequity around service in the army. How popular is that? What percentage of people support that?
Well, there's no question that, you know, a majority of Israelis support some version of a more secularized public space. And that's something that certainly covers the left, it covers the vast majority of the center, and even portions of the right. Mm. And that's primarily because, I'm not saying on this particular issue, but in general, when you talk about looking at issues that would define a more secular public space and a restraint of the influence of religion and Jewish law in Israeli life, especially in family law and on Shabbat, those are the two main issues, I think, and education, actually, I should add. It's coming down to transport to what kind of activity is open and available on Shabbat, family law, and education, to what extent religion plays a role in that. And the limitation of religious, you know, influence on those spheres is supported by, again, the full majority of the left and a large majority of the center, but also a portion of the right. The reason it's supported by a portion of the right is because some of them are secular. Now, Lieberman knows his constituency, his base, very well. He knows that the former Soviet immigrants, who are his primary supporters, are essentially right-wing, nationalist, and secular, and take their secularism very seriously. So that's part of the reason why there's support for that on the right. There is some portion, it's a little bit hard to estimate, it's not a huge portion, but there are right-wingers who are neither former Soviet immigrants who are secular and right-wing, but they are right-wing. In other words, they're native-born Israelis, but they are right-wing and secular. Mm. And this is an old-style Likudnik, you know, who were hawkish on security, maybe really traditional revisionist Zionists, but see themselves as committed to democratic principles and including, among those, secular state institutions. So he's hoping, I think, honestly, I mean, we're all trying to psychoanalyze our politicians lately, because we try to discern, why are they doing this, why are they doing that? I think Lieberman's goals are certainly big. Mm. In a way, he gives meaning to the term leverage. He takes a small number of voters and tries to leverage it into the biggest amount of, you know, impact that he can have. But I think that really what he's always wanted is to be a politician who wins not only among a particular community that's limited in Israeli society, and it's the former Soviet immigrants. Mm. I think he's always wanted to think that he has credibility in the wider Israeli population, and that issue does, you know, have the potential to reach a somewhat broader audience. If he doubles his votes, he should be very happy. The question is, I mean, he should be very happy. Whether the country should be very happy is a different story. But the question is, will he ever return to the one moment of success he really had? I mean, in 2009, he won 15 seats. That was when he really went beyond his constituency, took a big bite out of Likud's voters, and I personally think, you know, angered Likud, the leadership at Netanyahu, or made them nervous in a way that set off a kind of competition, outbidding for who could be the most provocative and the most populist and most a lot of things. But he hasn't ever returned to that. Even if he doubles his seats now, he'll be happy, but it's not anywhere near 15. Mm. I mean, I would be very surprised if he gets 15 seats, put it that way. So, you know, yeah, the issue is popular, but in truth, it's kind of gambling everything on that one issue.
Mm. And talking of issues, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about whether this is just like April, not an election about detailed policy, but an election just about personality, about whether this is about unseating Bibi or keeping Bibi. And to what extent do we feel that this election has really got out of the blocks? I mean, getting anywhere near to actually discussing issues. I mean, we've talked about the fact that, you know, religion and state, the power of the ultra-Orthodox parties has been part of it because of what Lieberman has done. But what other issues have we seen? I mean, we saw Bibi Netanyahu trying to make moves to try and ensure that he was made immune from prosecution under his corruption investigations. That hasn't really been much of a feature of the campaign. What, have there been other issues that you've seen that have really been significant? Or is this just a lot of noise and a lot of stuff about personality? What do you think, Anshul?
Well, if you go back 8 or 9 months, you know, we've had a very long and intense political season, basically beginning at the end of 2017, where the government broke up and elections were called. And ever since then, we've just had a series of cathartic moments. Now, one of the earlier cathartic moments we've almost forgotten about, but that was a huge thing that happened, was in February when the Attorney General put out his lengthy dossier explaining the three cases, why he intends to indict Netanyahu, hearing pending, obviously, over, you know, these charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. And that was there was a lot of detail there. It was certainly a massive moment when the Attorney General, first time ever a serving Prime Minister, had reached that stage in a criminal proceeding. And there was an expectation that things would never be the same after that. And for a week, perhaps 2 weeks, there was a period in the polls where blue and white and the centre-left achieved a parity, almost even perhaps slightly overtook. And that was and it was over. And 2 weeks later, the polls were back where they were. Netanyahu still had his advantage, and things hadn't changed. You know, we always knew these allegations were there for a long time, and every few days there's another bit coming out from the testimony, from the witness testimonies, and so on. And what we're seeing is this: it's all reached saturation level. Even those who don't like Netanyahu can't. You know, besides a few mad people like me, for us, it's, you know, it's our bread and butter. Everyone else doesn't really want to listen to it anyway. It's important in democracy. Yeah. All these things are coming out, but it's no longer a main factor in the election. It wasn't a factor at the end of the day in April. Certainly, it isn't now. And you know, if you're a campaign manager of an opposition party, you think, okay, you know, I have a certain amount of resources, not just financial, but of the attention span of the public. How much time can I actually hammer messages away? Am I going to waste this on more and more details of Netanyahu's alleged corruption, or am I going to try and find a more, I won't say friendly, but a more a message which actually comes over and just like make people shut down? And most people, unless they're wonks of this issue, sort of shut down now when they hear more details of Netanyahu's corruption. So that's sort of disappeared from the campaign because it's just not effective as a message.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that in a certain way, it's almost like there aren't very many issues on the agenda that make Israelis excited, optimistic, hopeful. And Benny Gantz kind of represented that in April because he offered the hope of replacing Netanyahu, which for many people, I think that it's important to say that Netanyahu isn't just a matter of whether people love him or hate him in a shallow kind of way. He actually represents certain things that are substantive and represent issues in Israeli society. So when you say are issues on the agenda, or is it just Netanyahu, it may be expressed in terms of whether people want Netanyahu to continue being prime minister or not, but I think that actually has come to stand for you know, people who support Netanyahu because they believe he is, you know, smart on the economy, great in foreign relations, uncompromising to the Palestinians, and somehow finagling, you know, relationships with the Arab countries, which is all good. And those people support him for that reason. And they think that all the cases against him are kind of a distraction, maybe a little bit of persecution. And on the other side, people who want him out resent what he stands for, not just him. They don't hate him personally. I think there's too much assumption that if people want to get rid of Netanyahu, it's because they have some sort of, you know, inborn kind of hatred of him. And I don't really buy it. I think that when people dislike Netanyahu, is they don't like his political style in terms of his rhetoric, which they find insulting, offensive to different populations. They don't like his governing style, which they find too consolidating, proto-authoritarian, dismissive of democratic norms. And they don't like his policy of status quo in the conflict, which is essentially de facto expansion of Israel's presence in the West Bank. They don't like his foreign policy because it involves consorting with authoritarian and dictatorial kind of despots around the world. And they don't like even his economic achievements, because it's all macroeconomic growth at the expense of anything like a more equal society in Israel. So we should pay attention to that, because people may not articulate all those things all the time, but they are somewhere in the back of people's minds, and sometimes in the front of people's minds. Of course, the parties have tried to put religion and state on the agenda again. It does feel a little bit lackluster. It doesn't really feel like people are... You know, I remember 1999 when people were jumping around the streets and bars going Nash control, you know, and it was all about, okay, that was particularly the Russian community saying we're going to take back control over the interior ministry, but it was a symbol of how Israeli society was angry about the religious coercion at the time. Nowadays we're talking about it, Lieberman's trying to make it his issue. It doesn't feel quite as passionate. That's because it's an old issue. It's just not a new exciting thing on the map. What is a little bit newer this time, I think, is an increasing focus this time and last time in April on the question of democratic institutions in Israel. And the whole kind of perception among the center and left that there's an erosion of democracy, and the perception on the right that there needs to be some sort of constraint on certain forces that they consider to be, quote, too democratic. And I say quote because I've heard people say that. That argument is new on the agenda, and I think it's new because there have been attempts to pass legislation that particularly target the judiciary and the Supreme Court, which has become the kind of nexus over the struggle about Israeli institutions, democratic institutions and democratic norms. And I think that is on people's minds, certainly on the left and apparently on the right, because in both election campaigns, there have been parties campaigning against the, again, quote, dictatorship of the court and promising to help restrain the court. Where, you know, many people on the center and left are say openly they are up in arms. They find that dangerous. They think it's, you know, damaging and dangerous to Israeli society in the future. And that's something that's a bit new. Even again, I don't think the parties are articulating it very well. And ironically, in April, the only party that dealt with it head on was a far right wing party, Ayelet Shaked and Tali Bennett's party at the time, New Right, who made it an issue and were proud to say that they intended to continue trying to restrain the court. The center and left, the opposition, blue and white, nobody really touched it. This time there's a little more attention to the whole issue of democratic norms. We have a party called the Democratic Union. And I guess we'll see if that issue becomes resonant in the end.
Just finally, I mean, in the last sort of couple of weeks of the campaign, in terms of predictions for like a final surprise, is Trump going to turn up in Jerusalem? Is Trump going to sign a defense pact with the US? Is any of this going to make a difference? Any thoughts about what you think the final twist might be in the saga? Another party pulling out the race? Do you want to make any predictions?
There's a term that you've used a number of times in the events that we've had the last few days. Priced in, Jay. You like saying that, and I think we are very much in a priced-in election. We know...
People have priced in these kind of events.
Whether it's the Netanyahu corruption or whether it's the Netanyahu statesmanship. I think Netanyahu deciding to, at the last moment, abandon his planned trip to Delhi. I don't think his trip this week to London, the meeting with Boris, was a compensation for the trip. I don't think we're going to see a picture of Boris and Netanyahu holding, shaking hands, going up on the fourth side of Mitzudat Zev Likud headquarters in Tel Aviv. We have seen Modi, Putin and Trump there, and I think that one of the reasons Netanyahu didn't go is that he decided that whatever he may yet gain from yet another photo op with Modi is probably not worth being away for 2 days at the crucial moment of the campaign. So everybody knows, yes, Netanyahu gets along very well with world leaders. Yes, there are massive piles of evidence against Netanyahu in the corruption cases. It's all priced in. The surprises that can still come are probably much more of an accumulation of little building blocks Netanyahu is trying to build by getting Zehut out, the Libertarian Party that he managed to convince not to run. Maybe he'll manage to convince Jewish Power not to run. And then there'll be all kinds of things that Dalia spoke at length about the turnout. That Likud are going to put a massive amount of resources in what the Americans call get out the vote. They're going to go from house out. And in Britain, we're used to door knocking as part of a campaign. It's much less usually part of an Israeli campaign. They usually rely on the fact it's a small country, the message gets across very well. This time they could have put in a lot of resources, both in compiling address lists and in preparing thousands of activists to go out and knock on doors and talk to people. Like I say, it's not usually a done thing in Israel, and it's because Netanyahu knows he needs to maximize his potential. He won't bring new voters from other parties. He will, what he'll try to, is to take the more apathetic Likud voters and just like chivy them and get them out there to vote.
You forgot the most exciting example of that, which is the advertisement he put out this week, or the Likud put out this week, which is a three-minute-long video clip.
I was leaving that to you because I know
how much I love video
clips.
Yeah.
That's your favorite bit of the campaign.
I mean, I can't stop listening to the video clip. You know, yalla Putin, yalla Trump, come to Jerusalem, see how great Israel is. I mean, it was really the tackiest thing I've probably ever seen in politics, but we're all talking about it. Here I am talking about it, and everybody on social media is talking about it.
And it's going to make you go out and vote Likud, obviously.
Me, no. But it is definitely aimed at his constituency. And in terms of, I'm just, you know, wasting time because I'm not sure what to say about your surprises question. I mean, in terms of a surprise electoral gift, what could Trump possibly have left up his sleeve, especially now that he's lost his special envoy after the resignation of Jason Greenblatt? But in terms of an electoral gift, it could be that his biggest electoral gift lies in what he doesn't do, which is, you know, already he's decided not to release this peace plan before the elections, and maybe now not ever. We don't know, but it certainly is good for Netanyahu because it portrays him as somebody who can kind of work with Trump and make sure Israel isn't pressured into doing things that, from the right-wing perspective, doesn't want to do.
I think it's important just to note, it's not a surprise, but this is happening as we speak. Netanyahu has been running a very toxic campaign accusing the Arab community of voter fraud, and it's a continuation of the Arabs voting in droves in 2015. It's a continuation of the attempt to put thousands of cameras in Arab polling stations in April, which was
forbidden. That was an order, wasn't there, forbidding that for this current election?
Well, first of all, during election day in April, in the middle of election day, it was forbidden. But the fact that Arab voters knew that there were people around there with cameras trying to put their cameras was seen by many, and I think justifiably, as an attempt at voter suppression. And now this talk of because what happened in the Arab sector in April, the Balad, the Arab party, got four seats, and New Right, Bennett and Shekhez, but didn't get in, and therefore four seats went.
This is what he's been saying.
That's what Netanyahu's been saying. That's what his campaign's been saying for a couple of days.
Not only are we seeing Netanyahu saying that, but we're seeing other figures in the Israeli political system saying
that. Yeah, we're seeing Shekhez saying as well. But it's now also an attempt to bring out one. It's another way to try and bring out the right-wing base and say, don't let the Arabs steal the election. The left and the Arabs are there. And like I said, it's not a surprise because Netanyahu has form on this, but this is very much like the end game of this election.
Thank you so much, Angel and Dahlia. That's been absolutely fascinating to cover so many issues, but thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed your time in London. And in Manchester, obviously, this is the first...
Mancunian accent along the way.
And so did Anshul. Back to his previous Mancunian upbringings. This is the first time we've ever recorded a podcast on a train. Apologies if there was some ambient noise in the background from fellow passengers and from the staff on the train in the announcements. But thank you for listening, and see us next week. Bye-bye.